You found the Diggin' Oak Island Podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thanks so much for downloading and listening. If you have been listening and you're enjoying the podcast, please do me a solid. Leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Also, I want to let you know you can join the podcast on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. As is the tradition on the podcast now, we start off with email time, my favorite. We have some follow-up emails from last week. First, we have William, who last week, if you recall, talked about the plausibility of pre-Columbian trips by Europeans to the New World, namely the Vikings and the Templars. This week, he writes, quote, I've listened to your podcast last night, and all I was pointing out was that the archaeological sites in Israel have discovered these massive undertakings of tunnels. The reference of Vikings being here long before Columbus had nothing to do with Oak Island. I just meant if they had come to the New World earlier, others might have as well. There are sites in Newfoundland that is believed to be evidence of Viking presence prior to Columbus. They had already settled in Greenland and Iceland, so it's easy to see that they also visited North America. It just seemed you were not sure of that, and maybe the Knights Templar may have some knowledge of this. That's all. Not that the Vikings had anything to do with Oak Island. William, if the impression I gave you is that I don't believe the Templars or the Vikings came here before Columbus, or that I thought you were saying the Vikings dug the money pit or something like that, that was not at all what I was intending, and that's just bad communication on my part. I, like you, have seen lots of evidence of the possibility that the Templars crossed the Atlantic, and it's very compelling evidence as well. It seems to mount all the time. All I was trying to say is I think it's important when discussing this subject that we recognize that there is a big difference within the evidence of the Vikings and the Templars coming to North America. With the Vikings, we have some serious archaeological evidence, almost proof, really. And you mentioned a settlement in Newfoundland, which is probably the most important. That's just not the case for the Templars, for whom the evidence is, you know, for lack of a better term, far less solid. And again, that doesn't mean I don't think the Templars' voyage to North America is out of the question. Quite the opposite. In fact, evidence of such a voyage seems to really be kind of ever-increasing, and even in the Canadian Maritimes. Take a look at the flag of the Mi'kmaq Nation. I've said this before, the local First Nations tribe in Nova Scotia. It has what looks very much like a Templar cross on it, for crying out loud. It's just that, in my mind, that kind of evidence is different from the kinds of archaeological finds that link the Vikings to North America, specifically evidence of an entire settlement, like I said, in Newfoundland. That was really my only point there. Thank you again, William. Next up is Carl. He wrote us last week as well. His email was about the boarding spike theory. He has a new theory for us to ponder this week. He writes, after this week's show, and he's referring to last week, of course, another observation came to light. This one is quite plausible. When the team dug at the swamp eye, they mentioned their tree trunks growing over the boulder ring, and Marty wondered how trees could grow in water like that. If this land was 10 feet higher, there would be no water there. So the eye may have been the original shaft or access point to a vast natural cavern. A major collapse would drop land level above it, allowing the swamp to form. Geological data of the island infers that a seam exists along the west side of the swamp. The smaller part, which the money pit is largely granite, I think. The part west of the swamp is a different strata. Given the nature of seams or faults, this would be a likely area for collapse. In summary, the eye, with its tree trunks embedded with iron pipes growing over huge boulders, was the original access. The cavern below then caved in, dropping the land above and creating the swamp. This seems to fit many of the clues the team is finding. Later, people came back and tried to access the cavern by digging what we now know as the money pit. I realize it all sounds a bit convoluted, but think about it for a while. It was the only way I can think of how to explain the eye, the swamp, and some of the other oddities. Thanks for your consideration, Carl. Carl, I think it's pretty obvious that we're going to have to set you up for one of these war room, what I called crackpot sessions, not referring to you as a crackpot, of course, for one of the future television shows. You seem to have so many ideas and been thinking about this so much. It's hard for me to keep up with them all, I think, and it's hard for me to keep up with all of them in general. But yours is, you know, very well thought out, very compelling. I mean, this certainly seems plausible to me. The thing is, the history of the swamp really is a great mystery for us, especially for television viewers. The average Curse of Oak Island fan gets so little information and history about the swamp from the show that it's easy for us all to think that the swamp has pretty much looked the same as it does now since, you know, people first walked on Oak Island back in the late 1700s. But it clearly hasn't. It's just not possible. All you got to do is dig a little bit deeper and you'll come to that conclusion. And also, there's precious little documentation on how exactly it has changed over those two centuries, no less the centuries before the discovery of the money pit. Up until Fred Nolan, the swamp really wasn't part of all this, and nobody paid a whole lot of attention to it. So there isn't much documentation there, and there certainly isn't much digging that's ever been done there. I've said this many, many times. Rising sea levels and the construction of the road that now lies between the swamp and the ocean are just two of the most obvious examples of possible major influences on the swamp's, you know, so-called natural makeup. But you also bring up a couple of other things in your email that I would like to expand on a bit here, the idea of natural caverns and the possibility of the ground collapsing. Now, I'm no geologist, and even trying to explain this is a little bit uncomfortable for me because I'm not sure I'm completely understanding it all myself, no less making it easier for you, the listener, to understand. But there is something in geology called karst, with a K. You can look it up. It's the natural process of ground rocks basically dissolving over the years and either creating underground drainage and caverns and therefore also sinkholes as a result of those things. Geologists will actually measure the essential risk of karst forming below you in an area where so that people who are there can be aware of how likely the possibility is of potentially hazardous sinkholes occurring around them or, God forbid, under them. The Nova Scotia government does just such a measurement and releases the information they find on the internet. If you look this up, folks, you'll see that Oak Island, along with much of the surrounding coastal areas of Mahone Bay, right in that region, are considered at high risk for karst forming. Therefore, possible collapsing and, of course, sinkholing as a result. It's kind of a sobering thought when you think about how all the digging and drilling done over the years here on the island. All the work certainly can't be helping the situation and likely makes it all the more dangerous and all the more likely for a sinkhole to form. But it also means that we may have a very natural explanation for some of the strange, you know, things like depressions and stuff. Searchers do often seem to jump to conclusions that these features must somehow be related to the mystery and just not a natural formation resulting from a geological characteristic present in the area. Think of the cave-in pit. Everybody just assumed the cave-in pit happened because it sits right on top of the flood tunnels. There's other explanations for why a cave-in pit, why a big sinkhole actually happened. This is a high sinkhole area. And also, it's important to note that skeptics have been using this sinkhole phenomenon as potentially natural answers literally for everything, including the money pit. It goes like this. Did McGinnis, Smith, and Vaughn actually find a depression in the ground made by someone who was digging a treasure shaft? Or did they just come across evidence of an old sinkhole formed by the natural characteristics of the ground below Oak Island? You see where I'm going here. Anyway, thanks, Carl. You brought up some great things there. Let's discuss an email now from Bob in New York. He writes, "It never ceases to amaze me how excited the Oak Island crew get whenever they uncover anything remotely resembling boat debris in the swamp area. Given that they have determined that the swamp is man-made, they should accept that the area was originally some sort of inlet between the island's two sections. Since historically there was a significant amount of ship activity in Mahone Bay, it's not a far stretch to assume that any resulting flotsam and jetsam might have accumulated in that inlet, like lint in a belly button. I also wonder if anyone has ever considered the possibility that a ship may have been intentionally sunk in the swamp area as a basis for landfill. Unseaworthy vessels have been used for this purpose for quite a while. From what I understand, these otherwise useless ships were stripped of anything useful, filled with stone and sand, then sunk close to the shore in places that were, you know, to be reclaimed by this from the sea. In the 1980s, such a ship was unearthed during construction of an office building on Water Street in downtown Manhattan. The practice was also used in the San Francisco Bay Area in the mid-19th century. I do not believe that any ship pieces found in the swamp have anything to do with treasure-laden Spanish galleon. They may simply be part of a landfill operation or nothing more than nautical belly button lint. Sincerely, Bob. Bob, thank you very much for the email. Really, I can't agree more with a lot of this. I've said this many, many times myself. An iron deck spike or something of other similar metal item of a maritime origin seems to me to be exactly what one should expect to find washed up on the shore in Nova Scotia. Look at a map. Nova Scotia is essentially right on the Gulf Stream, the maritime highway that almost every ship in the New World took to sail back to Europe. Even ships in the Caribbean would sail up the eastern seaboard of what is now the U.S. and then turn east somewhere around, you know, depending on the winds, near New England or even as far north as Canada, you know, really kind of depending on the prevailing currents and the winds and stuff. The waters off all of Atlantic Canada, Newfoundland and Nova Scotia especially were filled with sailing vessels heading back across the pond. Some crashed, some were swept away in a storm, some destroyed in conflicts, and more. The list goes on and on. Hundreds and hundreds of ships met their fate in the cold North Atlantic. And over the decades, the debris from those ships has washed up onto the rocky shores in places like Nova Scotia. No one knows this more than Gary Drayton. Why do you think he looks forward to passing storms and beach erosion? Not only do those things stir up the shoreline, but they also wash things up onto it. After one of these ships spends a few years in the bottom of the ocean, there's not much left to it but metal, and so therefore we get these kind of spikes and scrap lead pieces all on the seafloor and up on the beach. Now, it's for sure fascinating to find such things buried in a 100-plus foot deep pit, which they have found, but it's less fascinating on the shoreline. And yes, Bob, if we expect that at least some of the swamp was actually an inlet or the shoreline at some point, these things should also come as no surprise to find them there as well. And as for your other question, I would agree that using a destroyed ship as essentially landfill is certainly a possibility. But without getting too far into it, I guess the real question then is who did that and why? Sure, it may have been, it may not have been used to hide a treasure. That's fine. That makes all the sense in the world. But why join these two islands in the first place? For what purpose? And who would have the resources to do it? Especially before 1795 or before records. It would have to have been the Europeans, certainly to sink a ship in there. And it would have to have been from before any settlers were known to be living there. If we decide that your theory is correct, that this is just landfill, we still have these incredibly fascinating questions to answer. Sure, landfill answers the what, right? To use Rick Lagina's phrase. But it doesn't answer the who, where, when, and why. All right, let's head across the pond ourselves for the next email. This one comes from Philip, who writes, "Hi, Dave. Best regards from Belfast here in Northern Ireland. Great job on the podcast." Thanks, Philip. So I have a question for you. I remember one of the episodes from a previous series where the researcher Zena Halpern presented an ancient map which identified something called the Hatch. Shortly after, the team went to explore that area and found a square-shaped feature, which from the memory they poked a few sticks into and immediately declared it would be to be nothing. I just wondered what your thoughts are on this. Surely something shown on an ancient map, assuming it's genuine, where a corresponding feature still exists is worth a full-on investigation of some sort. Maybe there was more that went on there, but we only saw a summary on the show. Keep up the great work. All the best, Philip. Philip, thank you so much for the email. It's wonderful to hear from Northern Ireland. I think you may have answered your own question here, honestly. And if you didn't put that last sentence in there, I would have just said that. Maybe there was more that went on here. One of the things about the showrunners that really bugs me, and I'm not a complainer about the show, mind you. I've said many times I love this show. But one of the issues I often have is their resistance to showing us how and why they have essentially closed the door on something. For example, last year, they found what they were sure was the 90-foot stone. They spent episodes and episodes on it. They showed us the team hunting for it, cleaning it up, having a laser test done. And we got all the requisite multiple narrator overreactions to what it possibly can mean. But then sometime off air, they concluded it was a fake. But they never told us that on the show. Never told us why they concluded that or showed what information brought them to that conclusion. If you didn't catch an early Matty Blake show this season, you would still be wondering whatever happened to that stone. Many times the producers prefer to leave some of these discoveries, in air quotes, just hanging out there with no follow-up. At least the 90-foot stone got that one sentence from Maddie Blake. Most of them don't. And I guess they do this for us to agonize over in the future. I suppose they think this adds to the mystery of it all. But if you think about it, we can certainly tell on our own when the team has decided something is not worth any further investigation. Because quite frankly, that's the last we ever hear of it. And finally, we have an email from Emmett who writes, "Love the show. I look forward to listening while I work out each week. So I think I have watched the Petter Amundsen documentary Cracking the Shakespeare Code at least 5 times. While I can't tell you Oak Island will hold the Ark of the Covenant or Shakespeare's manuscripts, I feel like it will reveal itself as a center of activity for the followers of Francis Bacon, maybe the modern Rosicrucians under another name. Fantastic circumstantial evidence to ponder for years to come. But it really struck me. We are in the swamp and we find a stone that once removed reveals a shaft. And Amundsen just left us there in his documentary. Pierce the Mercy Stone is what he said. And the sight of Rick Lagina and Petter in the swamp in the documentary is something I think about all the time. Why didn't we talk about that? Too many theories at once. Keep up the good work, Emmett." Now, Emmett is specifically referring to the theory that Francis Bacon and his friends were the true authors of the works of William Shakespeare, and that Bacon, or maybe his followers, came to Oak Island to bury the proof of all that, along with some other religious artifacts that apparently they had. It's a very complicated and dense theory, perhaps the most dense theory you're ever going to find on Oak Island. It involves Francis Bacon, contemporary writers of his time, of Shakespeare's time, who also were associates of Bacon, a secret society called the Rosicrucians, and so on and so on and so on. Check out the documentary Emmett mentions. It's called Cracking the Shakespeare Code to get a better idea of all the different layers to this. I think you can find it on one or two of the streaming services. Amundsen starts with what he says is a secret code written into Shakespeare's first folios. They were the first published edition of the Bard's work, which coincidentally wasn't published until well after his death. From there, we follow an elaborate set of clues of varying degrees of plausibility. I don't want to get into all of them, but it has to do with like the first letter on page whatever. And we eventually end up on Oak Island. Amundsen, who is an organist, by the way, and not a Shakespearean scholar, which is nothing like that, which is really fascinating how much time he's put into this, believes that Nolan's Cross is actually a monolithic representation of something called the Tree of Life. He's not the only one. We've heard this before as well. One of the points on the tree is referred to as the Mersey Stone. And it seems that that Mersey Stone is located within what we now refer to as the Eye of the Swamp. Like he mentions, the documentary also includes Rick Lagina searching the swamp and finding metal hits that never actually turned out to be gold or silver like the film suggests, at least not yet. Here's another one of those things we mentioned before that just never seemed to be follow up on. If you watch this documentary, remember the episode. It certainly seems like they're searching around the Eye of the Swamp in this scene, although back then no one was calling it that, I think, so I'm not 100% sure this is the Eye, but it's awful close to it. And we know for certain Rick has Amundsen's information now to work with. So let's see if anything comes of this in the remaining episodes of this season. If there ever was a time to bring this all back up, it seems like this might be the time. So Emmett, let's go back to this. Let's talk about this again at the end of the season. With the work at Smith's Cove and Uplands coming to a conclusion, which we'll talk about in a second, the show will likely turn its focus really over to the Money Pit and the Swamp. Write me again on this, and let's reopen this conversation after the Swamp dig is concluded for this season. But you are correct. This could absolutely be a case of another example of Prometheus amnesia, so to speak. Well, thanks everyone for your great emails. If you would like to email me and have your question answered on a future podcast, just send it along to diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Okay, before we start our sort of review of this week's episode, we have some news to report. If you watch this on DVR and skip the commercials, like most people do, you might have missed the first teaser for an upcoming series called Beyond Oak Island. Now, there's little offered here in terms of details about the show, and like I said, it was only a very short teaser rather than like what you would call a full trailer. But in case you missed it, let me fill you in. The narrator begins by saying, quote, from the producers of The Curse of Oak Island, join Rick and Marty in the war room as they investigate the world's greatest mysteries. Investigating them from the war room, I guess. Then Rick says, quote, every treasure hunt is a puzzle, as Marty chimes in with a reward. Rick then follows up, go in search of the truth, in search of the answers. Throughout this, we see a lot of images. Author Randall Sullivan is sitting in the war room with the Laginas. There's also images of things like a half-sunken ship. There's Egyptian ruins and hieroglyphics. There's scuba divers appear to be opening what looks like a pirate's treasure chest. We then learn the series will premiere on April 28th at 10 p.m. And like I said, that's really it. It was a very, very short teaser, just a few seconds long. Now, after this aired, I read a ton of people on social media and places like that asking if the introduction of this show therefore means that it's the end of The Curse of Oak Island. We're always worried about that at this time of year. That's not been renewed. Is it coming back next year? You know, they think that this may be a sign that the team is moving beyond the current show and into a new one. I just can't see that being the case here with this, honestly, unless the show's very different than what this short teaser gives us an impression of. This looks to me just like a real easy way for Prometheus to get Rick and Marty, the people who everyone really comes to watch, let's face it, just to get them on the air for a few more weeks after the show ends. I mean, all the brothers have to do is sit around this table for a few days, apparently, and then just hand it over to the Prometheus writers and editors and animators to do all the rest, and voila, you have a whole new series. I'm not sure with what authority Rick and Marty Lagina can speak on Egyptian treasures, but whatever, I'm for as much Rick and Marty as possible. All right, enough of that. On to this week's episode called To Boulderly Go. I think the folks at Prometheus are obviously huge William Shatner fans, don't you? Seems I can't get over that. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that title. To begin, let me just talk quickly about a war room scene early in the episode. If you recall, I think it was last week, Gary Drayton uncovered a piece of what he calls scrap lead on the beach. Basically an undefinable, unidentifiable little piece of crushed up metal. Rick said that the good thing about it is that it was lead, therefore they could do this laser ablation testing, it's a hard thing to say, to find a lot more information about it. It's the same test they did to determine the date and the place of origin of the famous medieval cross. They gather in the war room to call up a Dr. Chris McFarlane. He's a professor of earth sciences at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton. We have seen him before on more than one occasion. It appears they sent McFarlane this piece of scrap lead, or at least some of it, for him to perform this laser test, and he has some results to report to the team. Oddly, he doesn't seem to offer up any theory on the date of origin, at least not that I picked up on. I know that's not exactly what laser ablation does, but sometimes the results that it gets can at least offer up some clues as to how you might be able to date it. But what he does say is two really important things. One, it has an unusually high level of mercury in it, saying, quote, I've never seen anything like it, honestly, end quote. And that this mercury had to have been introduced to the lead on purpose, since the process of smelting lead would essentially burn off any of the mercury in the material. So it had to kind of come into the picture later on, after it was made. And it's really hard to think of a good reason why anybody would do that. So it's not just a case of wherever the lead was mined, there also happens to be mercury in it. So if there's just sort of trace elements of mercury within the lead as they're pulling it out of the earth, once they go through the smelting process, the burning process, that mercury would be destroyed by that. The other thing is, it's fascinating, is that it comes from the southern region of the Mediterranean around Greece and Turkey. So the mercury content sends the narrator on a tangent about Francis Bacon, who we've already talked about here. Francis Bacon apparently experimented, or at least theorized about the idea of experimenting with preserving parchment in mercury. We've talked about this many, many times before in the podcast. It was just another of Bacon's many ideas. He had millions of them. But then when the place of origin comes up for discussion about this scrap lead, the area around Greece and Turkey, that then sends Gary Drayton off on his own sort of Knights Templar tangent. But here's the problem, Gary. Francis Bacon and the Knights Templar were not contemporaries, not by any means. They were centuries apart. So I see absolutely no plausible way this piece of lead could be made by the Templars but then used centuries later by Francis Bacon. There's no way the Templars could have pulled this lead out of there, handed it to Bacon, and said, hey, use this to help preserve Shakespeare's manuscripts that you wrote. You see where I'm going here? The two things just don't jive. I mean, you really have to invent some very elaborate plot to kind of make it all work. Also, another thing I'm curious about, during the narrator's aforementioned Francis Bacon tangent, he says perhaps Bacon used Oak Island and this mercury to hide Shakespeare's original manuscripts, which, quote, have been missing for centuries. I just hate the way this is worded here. This implies that there once was a historically documented collection of Shakespearean works that were written in William Shakespeare's own hand, and then they just somehow magically disappeared or were taken away. Now, I'm no Shakespearean scholar. Again, I'm just a podcaster. But as far as I know, that is not at all the case. Shakespeare famously did not keep any of his manuscripts. That's the whole point of the Baconian theory. It's perhaps the biggest thing that conspiracy theorists cling to in all this. Any idea that there exists somewhere lost in the world a collection of original Shakespearean manuscripts, whether written by Bacon or Shakespeare or whoever else you might think it was, that's just nothing more than a guess. That's just nothing more than a conclusion drawn out of these other theories that we already mentioned. Also, before we take a break here, let's stop quickly at Lot 21, where Laird Niven is doing an archaeological excavation of the Daniel McGinnis homestead. We mentioned this in a previous episode where Laird was just getting started on the project. In this episode, progress is being made, and what the team is hoping to find is an area they thought might have been something they called a sub-basement, like a secret cellar, I guess, which they found evidence of on a ground-penetrating radar scan done really some years ago. Later, Rick and Craig Tester come up and check up on Laird and see how he's doing. And by this time, he has uncovered what he actually calls potentially a, quote, trap door to a cellar or some other underground structure. I have to say, those are pretty big words, trap door, from the normally very reserved Laird. He shows them a bone knife handle that he found in the area of the cellar, which he thinks is from the late 18th century. He then points out that the whole area is a lot larger than he was expecting, and also that the artifacts he is finding are a lot older than he was expecting. But unfortunately, this may very well be the last of this project, at least for this season. As any further work or any, you know, to find this cellar or to dig it up would require a new permit from the government, and that's going to take quite some time to get, as permits often do. The first scene of the episode actually takes place over in the swamp, where Rick is escorting Dr. Ian Spooner, professor of geology in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at Acadia University in Nova Scotia, a.k.a. the Swamp Doctor, is escorting him down to the swamp to show him what the team has uncovered. If you recall, last week, Billy Gerhardt was digging in the area they call the Eye, and he came across a very strange collection of really huge boulders, boulders described as bigger than the ones that even make up Nolan's Cross. Now, if you remember, last week I said that finding such enormous boulders really makes me think this must be something natural, considering how Herculean a task it would be to move them. If you recall, Marty once said about the boulders in Nolan's Cross that he couldn't even lift one of those with the biggest excavator they had on the island. Also, what purpose would someone without any help from modern heavy equipment feel the need to do all of this work, this incredible work, to move these huge boulders? Well, it seems I was wrong again. Again, I'm just a podcaster. I guess sometimes I just need to remember that a little bit more than I do. Rick shows the Swamp Doctor what he describes as boulders sitting on top of the paved area. Now, again, here we are in a situation where it's really hard for us as the viewer to see exactly what Rick is describing here. And for some reason, the producers don't offer us sort of a wide shot of the area. Sometimes I think to myself, I wish Rick would just break the wall here and look straight into the camera, and point these things out for us. I mean, it'd be a little bit better, and at least we'll have an idea of what they're talking about. Instead, we get these quick shots. The Swamp Doctor is convinced this is not natural. He says pretty definitively, quote, this was deposited and filled in by the swamp relatively quickly, and that he, quote, can't find a natural process, end quote, for how this could possibly be there. If you haven't picked up on it, What he uses to make this determination is really pretty simple. He is finding things like sticks and twigs and the like kind of embedded in between the boulders. And those are things that would not be moved by some ancient glacial movement, since there were no trees when this area was covered with a glacier. Glacial movement is really the only natural explanation for why rocks of this size would ever be moved around. So you can see why the determination is made that this is, in fact, man-made. Laird Niven is there. He's looking at it, too, and he makes an interesting observation of how this looks like old filled-in cellars he's examined. It's really kind of crazy. The other interesting piece of information the Swamp Doctor offers us here is how similar he thinks this all looks to the paved area. Again, it's hard to make a determination on this. It's hard to really see what he's talking about. But I have no reason not to trust the expert here. Like I said earlier, I would think the swamp is going to be, along with the money pit, the focus of the remainder of this season's work. So we have a lot more to discuss here in the coming weeks. So let's finish the podcast here over at the Uplands, the small piece of elevated ground just inland from Smith's Cove. At the start of the episode, Marty Lagina is sitting at a table in his vineyard, the gorgeous Mari Vineyards in Traverse City, Michigan. He's on a video conference with Mark Monahan of Irving Equipment Limited, a heavy equipment contractor out of St. John, New Brunswick, I think. They do a lot of work on Oak Island. They've been involved here with this dig for many, many years, I think, at least for the last few. Marty is telling Monahan that their permit for having the cofferdam in place at Smith's Cove is quickly coming to an end. It's just about to expire. He says they have a month before this cofferdam needs to come down, and also mentions that it needs to be removed in sort of an environmentally friendly manner, meaning there are obviously regulations of some kind in place for it, even for its removal. Monahan says that they will need a couple of weeks to do it within the confines of these environmental regulations, and they need to get started soon if they're going to meet that deadline. This is essentially starting the clock now on how long they have left to work in Smith's Cove in the Uplands. And let me just mention, as we heard earlier from a listener of ours who visited Oak Island last year, this work was done early September, or at least mid-September. So you get an idea of where we are in the in this particular scene, at least in the chronological order of everything. Needless to say, work now needs to continue with some haste in this area, as the stated goal here at the Uplands is finding and stopping the flood tunnel booby trap system. Many a searcher has tried this and failed over the centuries, but that doesn't stop the Laginas and their partners from trying the same thing. Billy Gerhardt is digging a huge hole with a long-reach excavator, and geologist Terry Matheson arrives to offer his expertise on all this. They're finding what they think is a shaft, or perhaps a tunnel, with what appears to be sort of a wood wall or something like that. Again, it's hard to see here, but if you pause the show on a high-res TV, you'll see kind of what they mean and what they're talking about. The wood is covered in the dirt, so it is kind of a bit hidden or obscured from view, but you can get an idea. The team is pulling out what they describe as large hand-cut timbers, and we can see a couple of them as they come out. They're axe-cut, which means they're old, from before having power saws and that kind of thing. You can actually see the axe marks on it, apparently. Matheson thinks the wood looks very similar to the wood found in the U-shaped structure, or at least the cuts in the wood look similar to that. Remember, that was the wood dating to 1769, so this is fascinating if it turns out to be true that the two things are related. Rick goes for what can only be described as a white-knuckle ride in the bucket of Billy's excavator down to this wood shaft to get a better look, with Matheson all the time trying like crazy to get him to get out of that thing because it's a, you know, potentially a hazardous situation, let's face it. Terry is right here. This was a risky move. When Marty comes by, he at least gets in a harness and crawls down the top of the hole to get a bit of a better look for himself, and he declares that he thinks he sees the opening of a tunnel. So the team attaches a camera to the excavator, right to the bucket itself, and then they lower it down so they can get a real good look at it. Now, later in the episode, everyone is meeting in the war room to take a look at the video from this camera. Now, this might be tough to explain here, but have another look at the wood they are focusing on, and imagine in the frames of this video, and imagine a shaft or a tunnel that's actually been filled in, or perhaps maybe partially collapsed, and then the dirt has filled into it. If you think about it that way, you'll see why they're so excited. Now, here's what I know. Finding wood in this area is exactly what we would expect to find. Like I've said many, many times before, searchers have been driving wood into this area to stop the flooding for centuries. But I think there are two things that are important to bear in mind here. If that wood is pre-1850, then it's not from a searcher. And also, the Laginas are doing something here that no one has ever done before. People have dug in this area for sure, but not with the equipment anywhere near this kind of equipment. Not with a huge long-reach excavator. At least not that I can find any records of. I mean, I don't see anything like that. Now, surveyor Steve Guptill shows them how this possible tunnel also sits on a line that runs from the U-shaped structure past this possible shaft or tunnel, past the cave-in pit, all the way to the money pit. Honestly, it's hard not to draw the conclusion that these things are all somehow connected. But the problem is documentation of work done over the decades in this area, the uplands, is really a bit sketchy at best. So it's going to come down to whether or not these things could be dated and that dating matches. And we really just aren't there yet to make that connection. Is it possible this tunnel or shaft was previously found by another searcher? Sure. You know, as we've said, many searchers, if not every searcher after and even including the Truro Company in 1850, tried to dig here and tried to stop the flooding. Did they all record exactly what they did and what they found? No, of course not. We know that by now. So any conclusion on the date of what we are looking at here really depends on this important dendrochronology testing dating that they can do on these timbers. And any connection between the other areas, the U-shaped and the money pit and all that, all depends on this dating. So we wait to hear what this might be. The all episode ends with the first steel panel of the cofferdam coming out. And I think it's time for us to reflect just a little bit on whether or not this incredible year-long project at Smith's Cove will be eventually, as when we look back on it, considered successful. The whole idea of building the cofferdam really came, honestly, as a result of finding the medieval cross. Clearly, the team thought if they could really examine the seafloor in Smith's Cove, they would likely find even more artifacts along those lines. I mean, sure, they wanted to take a look at the U-shape and the L-shape. They knew those things were there, but this was really the goal. But really, they found nothing. No artifacts really of any merit, certainly nothing along the lines of that cross. I mean, a few things here and there. But even Gary Drayton said himself on more than one occasion in this show how he was expecting to find so much more and how he really couldn't understand why he wasn't. Also, they were trying to find the end of the box drains. But did they? Nah, can't say they did. They unearthed a strange concrete wall, but we never got any answers as to what it was and why it was put there. It was obviously searcher because of some of the features in it, but we don't know what it was there for, who did it. The same can be said for this wooden box, the U-shaped structure, the L-shaped structure, and even the wharf, really. They unearthed these things, and we all got the pleasure of seeing them, getting a really good look at them. And the team now has a detailed record of what actually is in Smith's Cove. But did they get any answers? Did all of this give them the answers they were looking for? I'll let you be the judge. But having said all that, they did get some information on the U-shaped structure, some important information. They got that date I mentioned before, 1769. And that's not nothing. That is something. Perhaps if this wood in the uplands dates from the same period, then we can finally get Prometheus and Gary Drayton to stop talking about the Knights Templar, who were clearly not in Canada, nor were they anywhere else for that matter, in 1769. So that's all for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Shameless plug time, I have another podcast. It's called Sit Downs and Sessions. You can find it on iTunes and all the usual places. If you're a longtime listener of this show, you'll recognize my co-host of Sit Downs and Sessions. He's my friend and radio host Chris Poe. He sat down with me for a chat on Oak Island back in the fall of 2019, I think, that we published here on this Digging Oak Island feed. Go back and take a listen to that. Chris and I spend sit-downs and sessions talking about pubs, some politics, a lot of the paranormal, kind of things like that. This week we did a two-part special, two podcast special on St. Patrick's Day. Have a listen. He even gets me to sing a few Irish tunes there. Please give us a five-star rating on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. It helps to get the word out on us and helps get more listeners for the show as well. Also, a giant thank you to everyone who has left a five-star rating so far. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do that and for the kind words. Don't forget, you can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Diggin' Oak Island. And again, if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, the best way to do so is via email, digginoakisland@gmail.com. Just keep in mind, if you do send me an email or even a direct message on social media or something, I may use it to answer here on the podcast. So if you don't want your message read aloud to all your thousands of fellow listeners, just please make a note of that for me and I won't read it. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.